living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe, maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon. This is Tyra St. John with Inside Out, and you're listening to KPFZ 88.1, Lakeport, Clear Lake, and all of Lake County. And a very, very wonderful guest today, who his name is Dennis Patrick Slattery. Dennis, we've been in conversation for a few weeks about your new book, and I was absolutely thrilled for you to send me a copy, and I've been reading it, and I was I've been reading the PDF file that you sent, and I've been very excited about your concepts of education, which are really kind of breakthrough ideas. You are a teacher and a writer and a teacher of writing, and just tell us a little bit about yourself and your educational background.
Well, to start from where I am, September this year will be the beginning of 40 years in the classroom. My background with education is a bachelor's degree in clinical psychology and literature from Kent State, a master's degree in comparative literature from Kent State, and a second master's in literary theory and the classics from the University of Dallas, and a PhD in phenomenology and literature from the University of Dallas. And then I've had the good fortune to have two Andrew Mellon grants to study at Rice University, one NEH grant to study at Harvard, and one NEH to study at the University of Arizona.
Wow, you're a lifetime learner.
I seem to have an insatiable appetite to learn, and decided years ago that if I taught, I could be paid to learn, and be paid to learn from both my students and from my reading, and here I am 40 years later.
Right. Well, and here you are. This is not your first book.
No, this, I hope the readers accept this not as boasting, but in humility. This is number 12.
Wow.
And I have two others in the works. I seem to be on the favored side of the muses who have been with me for, I'd say the last 6 years, and I'm taking full advantage of their presence because one never knows as a writer when the muses may decide to take a vacation and suddenly one has nothing to say. So I'm playing them, and they are very graceful ladies.
Well, not only do you have the muses with you, but you are a very, very busy man. I don't know how the muses get an opportunity to be with you at your computer while you do all this.
Well, thank you for that, and it's such a pleasure to be with you to inaugurate this book, which really was born about 9 days ago, and so it's just now starting to get into the world, and this is a wonderful opportunity to further that.
Right. The book is called Reimagining Education, Essays on Reviving the Soul of Learning, which is a really huge paradigm shift in our educational culture. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. You know, Tyra, the book grew out of some of my own Irish anger. And I've learned from other writers that I'm not the only one who has written out of anger. It's a creative way of channeling anger and frustration. And I think I heard the phrase, no child left behind, over the last 8 years, one time too many, and decided, I need to respond to that. How can I respond to an administration that wanted to highlight objective, uniform standards for learning, which has a place in learning. So I don't want to go all the way over to the other side, but there was something absolute about that phrase that made me realize I had to respond to it, and should I try to respond to it with a single voice and write a book about the imagination of learning as well as the imagination of teaching, or should I, number one, invite a colleague, which I did, and thank goodness I chose Jennifer Selig. I could never have gotten a better co-editor to work with. She has just been a dynamo And this book is in the world as much because of Jennifer's efforts as mine.
And she was a bit of a protege of yours.
She was a student of mine in the PhD in depth psychology program
right.
at Pacifica. And so this is a new experience for me. I've co-edited with colleagues, but this is the first time that I've co-edited with a former student who is now both a colleague and a friend.
And she also teaches at Pacifica.
And she's also on the faculty. At one point, she was the chair of the depth psychology program, but she has ratcheted back a bit in her involvement and teaches for us now on a part-time basis.
Right. Okay.
So the two of us put our heads together and said, let's not make this a collection of essays by faculty who teach only on the college level or only on the graduate level, but let's bring in people teaching on the elementary level, the high school level, and Jennifer taught 17 years on the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's give it as broad a band as we possibly can to engage a variety of teachers as well as a variety of teaching methods, and let's pose to them one fundamental question. What is it that you are able to do in the classroom to, we say, revive the soul of learning, which I think a fair translation could be revive the imagination of learning. What is it to learn from an imaginal rather than an objective analysis of point of view? And, of course, that can start in the early years of education right on through graduate work. And in a way, it was a pushback to the Secretary of Education's plan to objectify learning from the first grade through the PhD level.
Mm-hmm.
And if one were to just look at that mythically, then one might say, is the way that one learns, is the way that learning is measured or witnessed itself a mythology? And I think it is. What happens with a mythology that is this narrowly constructed, as Jennifer and I understood it, was that it only allows in those forms of learning that can be measured and quantified. And what can't be is kicked out as somehow irrelevant. Well, we thought that was dangerous. And we thought it was lethal if it was going to be the case that from first grade through graduate school, that became the predominant paradigm. And we asked ourselves, what is being lost in that compromise? And so, in essence, we asked 16 teachers, and we asked ourselves that, making a total of 18. What do you do? And if you don't want to give us a praxis-oriented essay, then speak theoretically about your understanding of the imagination, the intellect, and the full person in the act of learning.
Right.
So Jennifer had a little bit of trepidation thinking, what happens if we get Xerox copies of different modalities? And my instincts, I had no answer for her, but my instincts told me these folks that we're asking are such unique souls, which is what I think all of us are, that we should have no fear, even about overlap. And, of course, there's a bit, but each writer has lived teaching and learning so deeply and so uniquely that we sense, and, of course, the readers are the best judge of this, we sense that there are 18 distinct voices speaking about how learning can be a rich, bona fide, and soulful experience whose objective is not passing an exam. So that was our premise.
Or getting a job.
Well, see, now you touch on something that is really a hot nerve for me. It just attempts to defeat me as I hear more and more the language of education has one telos, it has one goal, employment. And not just employment, but employment at high salaries. So this fantasy has, oh boy, colonized the reason for learning to the point that people are having difficulty articulating, well, why else would one want to spend the money, the time, the effort, getting, for example, an undergraduate degree, much less a graduate degree, if it weren't to increase their checkbook?
Right.
And I think there's a bankruptcy, if I can just stay with the monetary metaphor for just a second, there's a bankruptcy in that approach because it's another form that quantification takes in a very, for me, sterile equation of learning equals employment. Again, not that that should be pitched out, but if that becomes the highest value in the hierarchy of learning, then I think we're in trouble.
And so that's what culture has to do with education.
Exactly right.
Right.
There's a wonderful Southern critic and poet, Alan Tate, who with a group of men in the 30s and 40s and 50s, Southern gentlemen, we'll call them, classically educated. And Alan Tate, in his essays, claimed that the role or the purpose of education is the preservation of language. That language is, and if there is anything that is bedrock for culture, it seems to me that it's language. Preservation of language, and then another book that I have found immensely useful is a two-volume set by Werner Jaeger entitled Paideia, a Greek word meaning education. And in those volumes, he asserts repeatedly that the goal of education is the continuity of the tradition of a people, not in a rigid, locked-in form, but that the values that a people hold most sacred ought to be the core of an educational experience. Well, these are very different languages to say something about the value of learning. And you know, Tyra, the other word that I almost never hear with regard to learning is joy.
Mm.
I think learning should be challenging, hard-won, and joyful. And they don't necessarily have to be in that order. But I know as a learner that the joy that I received in my education, or really probably had engendered out of me, was the reason that I went to the next course, read the next book, took the next test, moved on to the next degree, because there was a fundamental joy in the enterprise. And part of my fear is that under the rubric of objective quantification, measuring learning, all joy is going to be finally drained from the experience. And that's terrifying, because I think that's directly connected to dropout rates, students just giving up, students performing poorly, because there's no joy. And I don't mean fun. I hate it when that word fun gets connected to learning, that this is going to be fun. What I'd rather have is a teacher say, or not even say, but go ahead and demonstrate, this can be joyful.
I understand, and it's also excitement and passion and
yes,
the richness of the fabric of education, of,
yes,
of learning. It's where I know in reading just recently for myself as an adult, reading a lot of the Jungian books and a lot of, you know, people like James Hillman and
yes,
yourself, it's been so exciting for me because when I went to Pacifica, I loved it. It was
yes,
very exciting. But for some reason, I'm matured enough in those 15 years since then to read differently than I did then.
Yes.
And it's just pouring through me, and I cannot get enough.
Yes.
I just can't get enough of it.
Yes.
And that's the way I think children should feel in school.
Yes.
Of that excitement and passion and richness, and can't wait to get, you know, further along in the book and see what's going on.
Yes. Well, we have to that very point, we have an 8-year-old granddaughter. She loves reading over all of the other disciplines. She does very well in the Texas TAKS test. In fact, our son gave us a Xerox copy of her grades. She's third grade. She aced every question in the reading. And she said to me the last time we spoke, "Papa, I'm not liking reading as much as I used to." And I asked her, "McKinsey, well, what's going on?" And she said, "All we do in the classroom is read for the theme, read for the character, read for the plot, and I'm starting to like it less." Well, this is the candid appraisal of an 8-year-old smart student who loves to read. You see, something is dropping out. Something's being sacrificed on the altar of measurement. And the anxiety level of teachers who I've spoken to is exceedingly high because there's something insidious here wherein test score success translates into state money for the school. So there's almost an infernal, in Dante's world, almost an infernal feedback loop that test scores for X number of students, a test score that is high or passing, is directly connected to the money that will flow into the school for the next year.
I know, it's disgusting.
That's hard. That's hard to accept. Even more than that, Tyra, is the dispiritedness that I hear in our granddaughter's voice, who, when she stays with us, we read together. She reads the right side of the page, I read the left side of the page, and we do this dance through the text.
Mm-hmm.
If she loses that animated and joyful sense of reading, the world is going to have another non-reader or minimal reader joining the ranks, and that multiplied frightens me.
So the right brain is being sacrificed for the almighty dollar or the school's standing in the
yes.
state or the child's grades that will get him or her into the university or wherever
yes.
they are aspiring to go.
Yes.
And the right brain is the part of ourselves that we think of largely as less linear, more creative, more imaginal, that part of ourselves that is exciting and passionate. And it happens at the PhD level, where we are going through professor after professor on our committees, and they are really wanting to see all the quantitative proof, which is there, but it's more important almost than the content of what we're finding
yes.
in the research.
yes.
And it's very, that's demoralizing too. So it's demoralizing for, it takes some time to get out of that mentality.
Very much.
You've been in it for a couple of years.
Very much.
Okay.
I feel in the last 10 years, I'm 64 now, but the last 10 years, I have really come into my own as a learner, not as a teacher, although I don't think you can separate the two, but as a learner. And I was reflecting on that, anticipating this conversation with you today, and realized it may have taken 20 years for me to undo, or something to undo in me, a particular attitude towards learning that I have now found tremendously liberating.
How did you do that?
I think it was continually reflecting on what I was doing as a teacher, which was the mirror image of how I was processing as a learner.
Okay.
And what I think what has happened to me, and it's been very exciting, which is why I think retirement is just not in the cards for me. I mean, as long as my memory's working and I'm healthy, I want to stay in the classroom, is that when I enter the classroom, even having taught Moby Dick or The Odyssey or Toni Morrison's Beloved for 25 years, I step into the classroom with an attitude, I wonder what this work is going to reveal to me in this iteration with this particular group of students in this time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think I've undone, I appreciate your question because it's really making me think about it again right now, is I let go of the paradigm of mastery that, I mean, even to, for example, to call a graduate degree a master's degree, I'd like to change that nomenclature. I never felt that I mastered a single thing that I read, but I was asked to perform as if I had mastery over it.
Yes.
And what I want to shift is, why can't we offer a graduate degree in wondering? I mean, give people credit for their capacity, willingness, and ability to wonder and to wonder out loud, because I think wondering opens things up much more deeply than mastery ever has a prayer of doing. So I'd love to see that change. I think that's what's happened to me. When I step into the classroom, I step into it now as one willing to learn something that the last 24 years of teaching Moby Dick did not reveal to me. And, Tyra, what I've discovered is that is so inextricably connected to my level of freedom, of truly feeling free. Quite an astonishing thing for me. And I think that also was some of the energy behind putting this book together with Jennifer.
I can imagine that. I know that at one part of my education, I went to Goddard College.
Oh, yes.
It's when my true liberal education began.
Yes.
I didn't want to learn history at that point through numbers and dates and that sort of thing so much as about people. And
yes,
my very brilliant, wise teacher suggested that I read biographies in the last 100 years.
Oh.
Read all of them you want. Just enjoy.
Oh, boy.
And that's what I did. And it was just this wonderful, rich experience. And then when I was reading philosophy, and I was feeling, I guess, sort of existential myself, and someone
yeah.
suggested Camus, and I started on him and ended up writing a book on him.
Oh, beautiful.
You know, and it was just so, I couldn't get away from it. I loved it so much.
Yes.
That's the feeling. I'm sure that's what you want to engender, and not only yourself, but that maybe we should call our liberal education a liberated or a liberating education.
Yeah, very nice.
You know?
No, that's very nice.
Right. I wanted to ask you about how mythology and your analogy of Athena enter into the soul-making of an education.
Yes.
For the people who don't know mythology, maybe you can just give a line about who Athena is.
Yes, well, Athena, in the Greek system of mythology, is a daughter of Zeus who, if readers will allow this, to think of Zeus for a moment and without reducing him, but to think of him as the immortal equivalent of consciousness itself. And one of the remarkable things about Athena's birth is that she is born fully formed from the forehead of her father,
wow,
which creates in him mythically an enormous headache. Not that she's a headache, but giving birth to her in that fashion hurts the mind of consciousness itself.
It's so interesting. I see the parallel between that and actually Thomas More and the development of his daughter.
Yes, beautiful.
Isn't that right?
That's very nice. Mm-hmm. That's a great connection. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're exactly right.
Right.
So Athena is an interesting goddess because she is both warrior and knows how to use force, which in the Greek is Bia, B-I-E. She's also, though, and this is what I think she is so attracted to Odysseus and to Penelope for, is that she's also the presence of persuasion in speech. And the Greek word is metis, M-E-T-I-S, which is craft, which is cunning, but cunning not to deceive, but to persuade.
Right.
And so the Odyssey, Homer's 24 books, is as much about Athena as she is about this man trying to get home after 10 years of fighting in Troy and taking 10 more years to weave his way home. So Athena is that part of us that is persuasive and forceful. And not that those can't happen at the same time, because a person well-versed in speech can very forcefully, without physical might, very forcefully persuade a country to go to war, a country to wage peace, a country to move in a particular direction. Now, that's real power, especially when it can be done with words. So there's a scene, and in the preface, I allude to this scene that I'd love to share with listeners. And maybe I said readers earlier because I'm such a linear literary, but it's...
Well, you just wrote a book, so you hope they're also readers.
Well, no, thank you. That was the unconscious part of it. Beautiful.
Right.
Your listeners, there's a scene early in the first of the four books of the Odyssey, which are called the Telemachy, because they're about his 20-year-old son Telemachus, who was just born when Odysseus leaves to fight in Troy. And the suitors, there are 108 of the young aristocratic men, literally eating Odysseus out of house and home, and contesting for the hand of Penelope, because none of them believes that after 20 years Odysseus will return. So Athena comes down from Olympus and takes on the form of Mentes, M-E-N-T-E-S, which is teacher, mentor, but also carries with it the sense of mindfulness, being mindful.
Mm-hmm.
When and Homer shows us that when one is ruled by appetite and consuming, mindfulness is disregarded. So all of the suitors are filling themselves up and listening to music, and only one notices this stranger. And of course, in this 8th century BCE world, hospitality is the highest virtue. So Telemachus looks over and sees this stranger standing by the door and comes over to him and asks, who is Athena in disguise, to come in. He finds a seat for her, feeds her, and she in turn begins to speak to him about how he is of an age now to leave home and begin the search for his father. And this, of course, marks the beginning of Telemachus's formal education. But she says to him two or three times, if you have the mind to listen to me, I suggest that you do this. Now, this whole scene, which I think is one of the most important in the 24 books of the Odyssey, points out something that we don't normally talk to students about, and that is, have you, the individual student, made a conscious choice to learn? I posed that one time to a class, and they rolled their eyes and looked at me like I'd grown a second head. And they said, what do you mean, have we made a choice to learn? We're here, aren't we? And I said, yes, you are. You're in the classroom. But it doesn't follow that because you're here, you've made a conscious choice to learn. And then I asked them to put their hands up, those who had. And five or six out of a class of 22 put their hand up, because they felt they had authentically made a conscious decision to yield. Now, this wasn't their language, but this is mine. A conscious decision to yield something bigger than themselves and to be formed and shaped by it.
Mm-hmm.
This is Telemachus at this moment when Athena asks him, have you made your mind up to learn? And he assents. So she tells him what his trajectory should be, and then she leaves. The next morning, Telemachus, who has been whining because he's impotent in the face of these 108 young men, calls the assembly of the suitors and begins to speak to them, telling them what he feels about their usurping his household. Now, they're all eating, and Homer then describes how all of them immediately stopped chewing. The room becomes deathly silent, and some of them, Homer writes, put their top teeth against their lower lip. What they hear now is the voice of authority in Telemachus, which has never been there before until he was brushed by the divinity of Athena. Now his words carry persuasive force, and they recognize quickly that he has to be assassinated because he's now a power in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And as it happens, he leaves that night under cover of darkness and escapes being murdered by the suitors. I think it's a magnificent moment in the poem that suggests once one yields to this power of learning itself, voice changes, vocabulary shifts, a certain energy enters the voice because one has become more of who one is, not less, by yielding to something other than oneself. Well, what a marvelous paradox if we trust this moment that Homer gives us, which, incidentally, the Odyssey I have read was from its inception around 850 BCE up through the Renaissance, the first handbook on education. In other words, it was studied as a way of learning the seven liberal arts. This is the part I like to speak about in the classroom, of hospitality, that is, that relationship between the host and the guest, I think finds its analog in the classroom in the relationship of teacher to student.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean that the teacher is always teacher and the student is always student, because my own sensibility is that a teacher is a good one to the extent that he or she can become the learner as the student is allowed to become the teacher. So this arrangement of hospitality is not only a way to survive in the Greek world, in which when one traveled, one relied on households to take one in and feed one, and one would reciprocate if some stranger came knocking at their door. I think what Homer's giving us is the paradigm of what happens in a good classroom. Teacher's allowed to be a student, and a student can take on the mantle of the teacher so that there's a mutual learning going on all the time.
It's an amazing thing. You've just inspired in me the desire to read Homer.
Oh, beautiful.
I want to read the entire thing.
Oh, it's a magnificent story about teaching and learning.
I hope the language isn't too difficult.
No, no. And may I suggest the Albert Cook translation, which a Greek scholar that I studied with at the University of Arizona one summer used that particular edition, even though there are, so many fine translations out there, but I think the Albert Cook in the Norton Critical Edition with some wonderful secondary essays is one of the most accessible translations out there.
Is that a hardbound book?
It's paperback. I think it's $16,
okay.
Norton Critical Edition. And
great.
It's a gem.
Sounds wonderful. And it brought up two things for me. Thomas More was on the show a week or two ago.
Oh, beautiful.
And was talking about homeschooling, and I was very touched by the development of his relationship with his daughter, lovely adolescent girl,
yes,
who's being homeschooled by her dad. And I thought, what a lucky girl.
Yes.
And what a lucky dad who,
yes,
keeps growing through his experience and learning from his,
yes,
daughter. The idea of homeschooling is almost like soul learning or,
yes,
imaginal learning if it's done in such a way that, because Thomas More talked quite a little bit about what he had learned in being the student,
yes,
and letting her take the lead.
Yes.
And that's what Goddard College did for me,
yes,
was to let me do that. And that's what opened my mind to newer and greater wonderful things.
Yes.
Also, I thought when you were talking about how do you pronounce his name?
Telemachus.
Polemachus.
Yes.
When he moved his top teeth over his lip.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think of Clinton.
Yes.
You know,
yes, I can see the image immediately popped into my mind.
That's what he does.
Yes.
I hope he's learning at that. He's been very powerful in carrying persuasive messages to a whole culture.
Yes.
Whether we agree or not is another thing, but he certainly,
right,
has mastered that to a certain degree.
You know, the name, too, Telemachus, and I've seen different translations, but the one that I like, it means far-seeing.
Far-seeing.
Far-seeing. You know, television, Telemachos. I've heard his name pronounced Telemachus, but also Telemachus.
Uh-huh.
And far-seeing carries the connotation that when Telemachus leaves Ithaca, the first place he visits is the island of Nestor, who is the repository, as an old man, of more history than anyone else in the region.
Mm.
And then from there, he goes to the island of Sparta, where Menelaus, now with Helen having been retrieved from the Trojans, you know, has returned home. Telemachus then listens to the stories of Troy and from Nestor, and then shortly after listens to the stories of Odysseus, because Menelaus was the last one to see Odysseus alive. It suggests that, let's see, how best to say it. one doesn't have to kill someone in order to understand the psyche of a murderer. One doesn't have to go to war to understand the terrible suffering as well as the heroism that war seems to call forth. One can experience these in the imagination with a richness, I'm not going to say that it's equivalent, but with a richness that allows one to feel into these human experiences. So Telemachus is the archetype of the learner who realizes, and this is where I always get into a little bit of teeth grinding over the term the real world, that somehow education is preparing one for the real world. And I want to say that the classroom is the real world and the other is illusory. I want to just flip that language so that the imagination has the capacity to experience reality on a level that's absolutely profound. And I think that's what Homer is asking us to think about in those first four books of the Odyssey.
So the imagination is a quality of spirit.
Oh, very nice.
Right.
Yes.
And when we lock that in and don't open it to what's going on within the student or the teacher, we limit everything that's truly going on.
Yes.
We're limiting the dialogue, the conversation, everything.
Absolutely right.
That richness is a part of the fabric of learning that you and Jennifer Seelig are talking about, and also all of your fabulous contributors.
Yes.
I think very highly of Ruth Meyer's writing and thinking. She's a history teacher.
Yeah, I do too. I agree.
What does depth psychology have to do with history? I want to just insert here that your stories are wonderful, and storytelling itself is such a part of the muse of history,
yes,
according to Ruth.
Yes.
So what is depth psychology, or with imagination or the soul, have to do with history and its teaching?
Yes.
How do you perceive that?
Well, you know, for the last 6 years, and I just enjoy it every time I teach it, I offer a course on the writings of Joseph Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
It's always so painful to make the choices of the books that I've decided for that time to include because of all that then has to be excluded. But I usually choose 4 or 5 and ask students to read 3 or 4 of them, and if they can get to the other one, that's terrific. And I've done some writing on this, and I love your question. What occurred to me a year or two ago as I started to read more closely his passages on history, and of course, Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West, Campbell is to have read cover to cover in the massive 2 volumes at least 5 times. And at Pacifica's archives, the Campbell archives, we have the Spengler's Decline of the West in German, the copy owned by Campbell, and all of Campbell's very neat penciled notes in the margin are in German.
Mm.
When he would read the French medieval romances, he would read them in French, and his marginalia was in French. He was a true philologist. And I think he had a real strong gift for learning languages.
He must have.
Yes, he did. And reading Spengler brought him, and Frobenius and a couple of other writers, had him in his writing interface myth and history. And to the point that, and I want to share this with you and the listeners, what occurred to me is this image. If you took a jacket or a coat or a shirt and you looked at the outer sleeve, the fabric of the outer sleeve, that's history. Now, this works better if the coat is lined or if the jacket is lined. Then, and I've used this as a kind of visual aid that I have fun with in giving talks on Campbell, take that sleeve and turn it inside out. That silky or nylon lining is myth. So that myth is the inner sleeve of history. It's what gives history its texture, its resilience, and even to some degree its shape. And when I present this audiences, they seem to resonate with it almost immediately, that the myth that guides history is invisible, but it's real, and it can be exposed. By the same token, myth then is the a kind of eternal presence brought into temporality by means of history. So in my own clumsy way here, I'm trying to express an absolutely essential marriage between myth and history. Not only is the history of myth worth studying, and there's more and more books being published on that, but the other side, the myth of history, and this is where I think Ruth's book, which I've reviewed, is absolute genius, because she exposes the personal mythology of various historians as witness to the way they read the past. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and it's just, this whole area, Tyra, is so rich, and I encourage my myth students, especially those who have a love of history. This is an area that dissertations, books need to be written about from a contemporary perspective.
So myth and history reflect each other.
They reflect each other. They're
mirrors in some ways.
They're mirrors. And so depth psychology, I think, is an angle of vision both into history and into myth. I know for me personally, it's one of the reasons that I love reading Jung, because one of Jung's eyes always seems to be on history, and the other maybe moves through a number of disciplines, but certainly mythology. And I'm now, just in the last few days, have gone back to reread the Mysterium Conjunctionis, because alchemy is a form of mythology, and I hadn't thought about that. And when that idea came to me, I thought, now what would it be like to reread that volume? I think it's 14 in the collected works. What would it be like to read that work with the notion that alchemy is a mythological frame for understanding matter and spirit's relationship to one another? So all I've done is shifted my attitude, and now this Mysterium volume is like it's brand new.
I can understand that. It's a development of evolution almost. Alchemy can be that developing continuous change.
Yes.
In history and in mythology too, really.
Yes. You know, just to stay with for just 30 seconds, that idea of alchemy, I gauge a successful class by the level of an alchemical presence, where the prima materia, be it the novel we're reading or Inner Reaches of Outer Space of Joseph Campbell, I consider the text the prima materia, and to the degree that it is not mastered or explained, but alchemically let loose with its own energy field in the classroom, without our feeling that we have to come to some conclusion about it, to that degree that that's present, that class has had success for me. That's my gauge now.
Wow. That's an atomic explosion. we are 1 minute away.
No.
Yes, we are.
Oh, my God.
We're less than a minute away.
I've never looked at the clock this whole time,
no.
And I'm astonished.
And I have half of my questions left, and they weren't even the beginning. And so what I would like to do is have you back, and I certainly want to have Jennifer Lee Seelig back, or have her on the show.
Wonderful.
This is the DNA of Carl Jung, this series, and
yes.
You are such a deep and wonderful thinker.
Well, thank
and
you.
I wish you could come to Lake County and take us on.
I'd love it.
We would love it.
Thank you.
I just appreciate your being here so much. This Dennis Patrick Slattery is the very recent editor of an anthology that is remarkable. He is a co-editor with Jennifer Seelig.
Seelig.
Jennifer Lee Seelig.
Yes.
And they wrote Reimagining Education, Essays on Reviving the Soul of Learning. And we didn't mention so many of the writers because we didn't have time for it. It's a very deep and wonderful book about how we can begin to allow this new paradigm to emerge, which I think it already is, as Dennis has said. Many, many thanks for being here.
This has been a gift to me, Tyra, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank your listeners. It's just been a joyful 1 hour, and I can't believe it's over.
Thank you so much, and we'll do it again. I'll be in touch with you. And I wanted to ask you what Werner's last name is?
Jaeger.
Jaeger?
Yes, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, it's Jaeger.
Okay, great. Many thanks.
Thank you, Tyra, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Very soon. Thank you so much, Dennis. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Tyra St. John. I'm absolutely delighted, as usual, with these fabulous teachers and authors we've been able to get on the show with this series about Carl Jung called The DNA of Carl Jung. This is Tyra St. John on Inside Out, closing off. Stay tuned for our stories, our lives. I'm gonna make it.